Support for WPR comes from Luther College in Decorah, Iowa, a community where students are invited to learn actively, lead courageously, and live purposefully for a lifetime of impact. More about Luther College at luther.edu.
So what if you don't get the chance to age normally? What if, by birth or by accident, your face looks nothing like what one of those facial identification algorithms might recognize? There's an emerging option for people with severe facial disfigurements, and that's facial transplant surgery. The first one took place in France in 2006, and since then, about 30 people have undergone what is a grueling procedure. In 2012, a team at the University of Maryland Medical Center attempted the most extensive face transplant yet. Steve Paulson asked the lead surgeon, Dr. Eduardo Rodriguez, about meeting his patient, Richard Norris. A note for some of you, it's a little graphic.
The first time he met was in 2005. I had received an inquiry from his mother to see if I would be willing to take on his case. She mentioned a little bit of the type of injury that he had sustained, the types of procedures, and asked if I would be willing to take on his case. And the first time I met him, he came in wearing a baseball cap, as he traditionally did for a number of years, a surgical mask to cover his face. All you could see was essentially his eyes.
His original injury was from a gunshot wound to the face, right?
That's correct. A self-inflicted shotgun injury, accidental shotgun injury in 1997. And he was initially treated at one of the main institutions in North Carolina and then had a number of additional procedures in Virginia. And that's when sort of they reached the end of the road and they got to me.
So what did he look like once he took off his mask?
He was missing his nose, did not have any upper and lower lips. The opening of his mouth aperture was very constricted, almost like the size of a belly button. He could barely speak, did not have any bony support to the midface, and did not have any bony support to the lower jaw. So he had a very, very small face compared to what you would consider a normal appearing face.
Now, obviously, the face is absolutely crucial to our life and to how we interact with other people, how we are seen by other people. How did Richard's disfigurement affect his life up until then?
Well, I think like most of these patients, they have, you know, they undergo an injury and they just want to get fixed up and get back to their normal lives as they saw it before their injury. But what Richard realized that life that he knew was pretty much gone. As he attempted to try to go back to his routine, what he found was that people were staring at him. And then he tried to conceal what it was that people were staring at. So he covered himself with a mask. And even with the mask, what he found was that more people were interested in what was behind the mask. So then he went on to conceal himself from society as much as possible. And it became very difficult for him. He wore almost like a ski mask that people wear in high-altitude skiing to keep their face warm that goes over their nose and their mouth. And on a number of occasions, he walked into convenience stores. And at the convenience stores, they felt that it was a heist. The police department would be called. And he went through this a couple of times, and he was incredibly embarrassed. And that's why he really almost became a recluse, avoided social interaction as much as possible. His life as he knew it had dramatically changed. And despite all the surgical procedures that he had performed, he would look at pictures of him before the injury and he realized that he wasn't anywhere near that appearance that he had before his injury.
Right. So 7 years later, after that first meeting with him, you and a team of doctors performed a marathon face transplant operation. What did you do?
We spent a number of years working on him, and obviously we weren't getting to the level of appearance and function that he desired. And he had asked about facial transplantation for a while.
And only something like what? Only 30 have been done around the world to this date. I mean, this is not a common operation by any means.
That is correct. And when Richard was asking, we were probably in the number of the teens. There really wasn't a tremendous amount of foundation and research. We didn't really understand how long these face transplants would last. And it was a big challenge because until that point, there had been a number of transplants that have occurred the majority were soft tissue, some inclusion of bony segments, but it wasn't the majority. And we wanted to give him teeth. He didn't have teeth for 15 years. He needed a portion of his tongue. So all these complement of tissues, the full face with the eyelids, the nose, the lips, nothing of this magnitude had ever been performed.
I mean, this is astonishing what you're saying. I mean, you're saying you didn't just give him a new face. I mean, you reconstructed the infrastructure of his face. I mean, this is astonishing.
That's absolutely correct. And that, at times, requires going back to the demolished state and building from new. If this were to fail, the patient would likely be much worse off than he was prior to the surgery. So this is high-stakes surgery.
And so not only did you have your patient here, I mean, you also need a donor face as well, right? I mean, how does that work?
We work with an organ procurement organization that is identifying patients that meet our specific criteria. And that criteria is defined by blood type. We try to look at specific markers within the blood that will match the recipient as close as possible to limit the amount of rejection. Keep in mind, all patients will have rejection because these are individuals that are genetically mismatched, that have totally different DNA. But we try to control that as much as possible by matching these patients as close to possible as we can. So that involves blood work. Then on top of the blood work, we try to look for patients that have similar characteristics. That means the color of their skin, the dimensions of their skeleton. We even try to match the color of their hair and their eyebrows so that we can blend everything in.
Does the face of the donor have to resemble the face of the person who's going to get the new face?
It doesn't necessarily have to. But when you take a donor face and you put it on the recipient, it's a very unique blend of both individuals.
So take me to the day of the surgery. I mean, this surgery, which lasted how long? I mean, how many hours?
We worked for approximately 36 hours.
36 hours for this one surgery?
For this one surgery.
Wow.
It's a lengthy procedure, but the way it happens, we had identified the donor. Richard got flown up from Virginia. We have an elite team of surgeons where we've practiced this operation on cadavers, and we simulate this exact operation 15 times before we actually do this. So we know exactly what step to do. Everything is timed and rehearsed to the T. We have to remove everything very carefully. We have to identify the nerves that will move the face, the nerves that will provide sensation to that face, define the muscles, make precise skeletal cuts on the jaws of the face so that it fits the recipient face perfectly. Once we finish that donor dissection, at that point, we've reached a point of essentially irreversibility, the point of no return, where we actually remove the face of the recipient, the face that he, in Richard's case, had lived with for 15 years. And everything is prepared to accept this new face, which is coming with all the tissues, the skin, the muscles, the underlying fat, the nerves, the tongue, the teeth, everything has to fit just like a puzzle.
What was the hardest part of the surgery?
For me, I think the biggest concern was if this face were to fail, that I knew that I'd, at this point, had made Richard worse than he was before he entered that operating room. So when your face, the facial allograft doesn't take or it doesn't work, now we're looking at a pretty sizable wound in the face. And although we can temporarily cover it and care for it, it's a difficult problem to be facing.
What did you think your odds of success were going into this surgery?
I always told Richard and I told my team, and I go, despite everything that we trained, the possibility of failure is limitless. And I wanted to make sure that he and his family had complete clarity that this had never been performed in the history of medicine and that the risk was tremendous.
So how did it go?
Thank God, perfect. But I'll tell you. Once we connected the blood vessels and we see this face that was white sitting in a cooler become pink, you could almost hear everyone in the operating room cheering. But we still have another 18 hours of work to do. So we connect all the blood vessels, the face pinks up. stabilize the skeleton, we fix the teeth, we fix the jaws, we put all the hardware, all the screws, all the plates, we reconstruct the internal lining of his mouth, we suture the palate, put the tongue together, connect all the nerves, and we get him out to the recovery room. Now we got to wait for him to wake up. Now the biggest challenge for me, when he asked me for a mirror, is that going to be what he expected? So on the second day when he was more awake, he wanted to look. He desperately wanted to look. And the moment he looked, I will tell you, there was not a dry eye in that room. He just stared. And he touched his lips because he hadn't had lips in 15 years. And he just looked at me and hugged me and thanked me. It was a pretty emotional moment.
Oh, I can imagine. Wow. But he couldn't smile, right? I mean, it takes actually years to develop the ability to smile.
We expected recovery time on him to be fast. And sure enough, we actually biopsy the tissue every week to make sure there are no signs of rejection. And very early on, I couldn't biopsy him without local anesthetic because it bothered him. He didn't shave because I didn't want him to shave to irritate his face. He goes, Dr. Rodriguez, I really want to shave because I hate when my hair grows long underneath my neck and it itches. And I went, my God, you know, he has sensation in his skin from the facial hair growth. And he could smell, finally.
He couldn't smell for all those years?
He could not smell for 15 years.
Wow.
And he was walking outside. We would take him for routine physical therapy walks outside of the hospital. And he's walking outside, and they're mowing the lawn. And he just pauses, and he's looking at this lawnmower, and he's smelling fresh-cut grass. And he goes, God, I haven't smelled that in so long. All these things that we take for granted, every discovery for him was just an incredible milestone. And it was wonderful to watch all of that happen before us. And now when we fast forward the clock and you look at him now, I think for me the greatest accomplishment, and I think for all of us, is to see this individual who came into our clinic in 2005, concealing his face, not wanting to talk, that now he will walk into a room full of people and he will put his face right up against yours and talk to you as if he were just another average person, really a remarkable accomplishment to see what he's undergone through from a psychological standpoint, from a self-esteem and confidence standpoint is just amazing.
Does he look much like he did before he had his accident? I mean, he's a lot older now, of course, but I mean, do you see a resemblance there?
You know, I'm biased because I was a surgeon that did this, but I'm going to say he looks better. When you... And I will say he gave such a remarkable speech at a Gift of Life gala where we honored the family that not only donated his face but donated all the other organs, and all these family members were there. And I took a photograph of Richard in his black tuxedo with his black tie, and his hair is combed back. He looks like a movie star. And obviously my disclosure is that I'm biased, but he looks remarkable.
So given your kind of firsthand observation of all of this, I mean, what do you conclude about the connection between personal appearance and identity?
It's a great question. When these patients with severe disfigurement look in the mirror, they do not see normalcy. They do not see that individual who looked like before the injury. So all these issues, all these concerns, all these potential identity crises that we thought would arise haven't been the case. We've not seen this in 30 patients. What we've seen is that patients actually improve and feel that they're normal and they can interact. When he looks in the mirror, and even his family tells him, it's Richard. It looks like Richard, an older version of Richard, and it's what they see. And that's exactly how Richard sees himself.
Eduardo Rodriguez is chair of the plastic surgery department at NYU's Langone Medical Center.